Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So it's the middle of summer. Actually, it's towards the end, but you might be looking at trees and shrubbery around your area and seeing maybe a berry, a blackberry or something like that, and think, can I eat that? What should I do? Can I? And, you know, other sort of herbs, maybe some oniony grasses. But actually, much of this is sort of in vogue right now. So wild foods have been popularized by the Noma chef over in Copenhagen, and it's kind of blowing up in the last few years. My guest today is actually a professional forager, and he is his name is Pascal Baudard. He is a wild foods instructor, a self-styled culinary alchemist based in Los Angeles. He's been featured in numerous TV shows and publications, and he was also named in 2014 one of the 25 most influential tastemakers in LA by Los Angeles Magazine. So Pascal has written a cookbook called The New Wild Crafted Cuisine, exploring the exotic gastronomy of local terroir. And I'm so excited to be joined by him on the line. How are you, Pascal?
Bonjour. I'm doing good.
Excellent. Thanks so much for this gorgeous book. And it's really eye-opening because I've taken some foraging tours. I've made some salad using dandelion greens, but you have a crazy arsenal of techniques and just know-how. And just to kind of throw out some hits out there, you've taken various barks to make smoked vinegars. You've created insect sugar to brew primitive beers. I'm talking like next level wild food cooking. So actually, if I may start out, Pascal, I got to admit something. I was looking up in the news because, you know, this is summer. Maybe a lot of people are foraging or just trying for the first time to pick something in the wild. I was looking around for some reports of somebody dying from like a mushroom that they didn't know was poisonous or something like that. And lo and behold, I really couldn't find anything. Like, I was trying to be like a devil's advocate, but this doesn't seem to be something that happens. So that's good. I don't know. Have you seen that?
You know, it's interesting. At this time of the year, what you will be looking for is in Southern California, is actually seeds. Mm-hmm. And seeds are completely everywhere. And people have no idea. They look at the environment and say, my God, this is so dry. There is nothing to pick up. And they don't realize they're surrounded by gourmet seeds.
Wow, gourmet seeds. What would they look like? Because you've made pickled acorns. I didn't know that was something I could eat. What are some of the what are the other seeds we could be eating?
Well, a good example would be right now, near Los Angeles, we have tons and tons and tons of wild mustard.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
And it's actually a very invasive plant, and we probably have like 7 or 8 different types of mustard. And the flavor range will go anywhere between broccoli to wasabi.
Oh, yum.
This time of the year, I actually collect a lot of black mustard seeds, and I use them to make gourmet dish mustard, for example.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. Another seed that you've provided a recipe for here is something that is very trendy right now. It's chia seeds. And they can be quite expensive, but apparently you can find them in the wild, which I did not know.
Yes, actually, the seeds that you buy at the store are not the native seeds. The native seeds in our area, I have to pick them up in the desert. And those are the golden chia seeds. Mm-hmm. So it's a similar flavor, but the seed pods are much smaller.
Yeah.
And the color of the seeds are different, so it's much more work to actually collect.
I would imagine. How exactly do you collect all these tiny little seeds? without spilling them? And I don't know.
Well, I mean, for example, mustard is pretty easy. It's everywhere.
Okay.
So I basically grab the seed pods and I put them into a plastic bag. It doesn't take me a long time. And then I come home and then I basically just trash the bag, like bang on it with a stick or walk on it. And I open all the seed pods and they fall at the bottom of the bag. And then I create a little hole at the bottom of the bag and collect all my seeds. There's still some shaft there, and then I just blow on the shaft. The shaft blows away because the seeds are, more heavy. And then there you go. I can collect 2 or 3 cups of mustard in one morning.
Wow. So that sounds like kind of fun. You kind of like shake them out and separate the seeds and go from there. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, another thing that I've seen a lot of people eating that I didn't know before you could eat is pine needles, and that's everywhere. And it has a wonderful fragrance, but what can we do with that? What would you suggest?
The pine needles, it really depends on what pine. All pines are edible, but you're going to have all kinds of different flavors.
Yeah.
I like to use white pine, which is really has a little bit of orange flavor to the needle. I also like to use white fir, and I also like to use pinyon pine needles, which taste a little bit like tangerine.
Wow.
And I use them to make soda. I don't know if you know. It's not in my book. It's a new discovery. But the unripe pine cones are actually loaded with wild yeast.
With wild yeast. Okay.
Yes. So you can just put that in sugar water with a pine cone and some branches, and you can make the most incredible pine soda.
Wow.
Like lemony, you know, orangey, tangerine flavor. It's very interesting flavors.
It is. So the pine needle, white fir, and lemon soda, it sounds very easy, too. So I'm really attracted to this recipe. And I understand that pine needles are packed with vitamin C. So
that's correct.
Yeah. So wasn't it an early way of sort of preventing from scurvy too? Just grab some leaves and or pine needles and kind of munch on them.
I remember seeing
that.
And the survivalists actually make a tea out of it, and the tea actually tastes like lemon type of thing.
It sounds wonderful. Why aren't we doing this more often?
You know, people forgot. People don't know anymore. People have been, you know, going to the markets. It takes one generation to lose everything. Like, my grandmother still knew a lot of this stuff. And she used to go foraging and go into the garden. And then my mom stopped doing that and went to the store. And everything got lost. So it takes one generation, and all this knowledge is gone. People have no idea of what is in their surrounding. Like, none.
There's
probably 450 different ingredients that I can collect in the wild.
Wow.
And that's more than... Yeah?
Oh, go ahead. That's more.
I'd say it's more than the Santa Monica market, for example.
It's true. And it's probably healthier in a lot of ways, too. So, Pascal, tell me a little bit about how you came into foraging and how you learned it and you know, who taught you, your mother?
A lot of people told me. So I basically grew up in Belgium in a tiny little town of maybe like 3,000 people, if that. So nothing to do. you know, I grew up kind of like in the 19th century in a small farm, you know. And we had a garden, we had rabbits, we had, chicken, and I spent most of my time in, you know, basically just wandering the woods as a kid, and, you know, I started learning that way, how to collect hazelnuts, walnuts, you know, how to collect stinging nettles, and make food out of it. So it was normal for me, and the elders at the time, you know, still knew all this good food that, you know, the nature was not looked at something weird or something that you cannot touch. Nature was looked at something that you can work with and also as a source of food, you know, and how to do it the proper way.
Right.
And then in the 90s, I was at this, you know, I traveled all over the world, and in the late 90s, I was actually living in Southern California. And I became interested to take a look again at, you know, local wild food. And I probably did 400 classes with all kinds of people, from survivalists to native people to botanists, anybody who could teach me. And I became obsessed with really looking at the flavor, not only of Southern California, but looking at the true flavor of an environment, be it in Vermont or be it in Southern California or Oregon. It doesn't matter. You basically have a terroir mm-hmm. with very specific flavor that are really pretty much untouched by people.
When we think of terroir, we often think of the commercialized goods from that particular area. So if here in Brooklyn, I'm kind of close to this place that makes smoked fish. So that's, but it's not really, it's a manufacturer. It's not something found in the wild, although we're not too far from the ocean. But anyway, you get my point. We don't tend to think of the things that are actually part of that natural wild environment as our terroir.
But it's true. But like, for example, I was in I went to do a trip in Vermont in June, and as an example of cooking with a terroir, we actually went to the forest, and then we pick up white birch branches and leaves. We pick up wild sassafras roots. We made wild yeast with some of the flowers that we found, and took some maple syrup, and we actually make a primitive beer, and then we cook some rabbit in it, which the rabbit actually came from the environment too. Mm-hmm. So it was basically a rabbit cooking a primitive beer made with its own forest.
Mm-hmm.
And you can outgrow, yeah.
It doesn't get any more local than that. It's something that this is the home for these ingredients. So what is it like when you go back to your town in Belgium? Are there still elders? Are there still folks who have picked up these, like you have, picked up these skills that are still forging?
Not really. I don't go there very often, to be honest. I go there every 10 years to say hi. But this year I'm overdue. I have to go say hi to my dad. But not really. It's really, it's like here in America, people go to the market at this point. So it's really pretty much lost.
Oh, dear.
From a culinary perspective. But I think it's getting back slowly thanks to, as you were saying, restaurants like Noma and places like that. I mean, in Denmark, it's definitely came back, and they really reinvented their own cuisine by reinterpreting and looking at, what nature was providing to them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting because these are places where, it's not exactly a tropical environment. We don't think of it as being particularly lush in, wild fruits, vegetables, and herbs, and you name it. But it's actually vast, so that only goes to say how vast every place is in terms of wild foods.
People have no idea, but the book is really 432 pages or 37 pages of ideas of what you can do with wild food, and it's not just about Southern California. I mean, we're talking about making spices, wines, beer, making your own vinegar using fruit flies, and all kind of crazy ideas, but it's really going deep into the true flavor of an environment.
Yes, I want to talk a lot more about some of those crazy ideas, but we're going to cut to a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more.
Sure.
And this is Walking Like a Cowboy by Techstar. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Peter Kim, the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. We're a nonprofit founded by Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues here on the Heritage Radio Network. And we want to take people on a learning adventure through the world of food. We just opened MOFAD Lab, our gallery space at 62 Bayard Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we are currently showing Flavor, Making It and Faking It. Flavor features some very cool sensory interaction. Flavor tablets deliver tastings of vanilla and umami, and the Willy Wonka-inspired smell synth lets you compose over 500,000 different flavors. So come on by and visit MOFAD Lab. We're open 5 days a week, and tickets are $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Learn more about the Museum of Food and Drink at mofad.org.
All right, We're back. This is Eat Your Words, and we're talking with Pascal Baudard, the author of The New Wild Crafted Cuisine, exploring the exotic gastronomy of local terroir. So, Pascal, we were just talking about how this is sort of like a lost art, learning how to forage. And I'm curious if you have any tips, because this is a wonderful resource. This book, you know, as you mentioned, has hundreds of recipes and ideas for what to do once you grab things like, you know, pine needles, as we were discussing, things you can easily find, and even more advanced things that you can, you know, look around for a little bit more. So this is invaluable. So thank you so much for sharing some of these folksy knowledge that you've learned. But I'm curious what you would say to somebody who's just starting out and maybe a little bit intimidated by the wild. You know, how should they approach? Should they take it, you know, one thing at a time? Should it focus on, say, one kind of mushroom and go for that? Or just kind of keep your eyes open and look all around you and see what might be an edible green?
Okay, so the best advice I can give to people is find somebody local who can teach you. It's probably the best advice I can give you. It's really hard to study from books. You know, you basically need somebody who can teach you. I mean, look, plants, you know, the way I teach people is, you know, you can smell the plants. So you have to take a look at them, look at the details, you know, how do they feel? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the best environment for flavor? So there's a lot of things that you can teach people, and really the best ways, it's really a knowledge that is being given down by people to other people. Mm-hmm. It's really, at one point you can become independent, but it takes a while. So if you knew, just find, there's tons of local people. Just Google it, you know, find, you know, instructor, wild food instructor, and you know, I know in Brooklyn, I think you have like 3 or 4 people teaching.
Yeah, on that note, I might give a shout out to Wildman Steve Brill. Long-time foraging expert here for Central Park, Prospect Park, and all sorts of places. So,
yeah,
yes.
There's Marieville Jean is another one. You know, there's a bunch of people. Lida Meredith is another one, too.
Yes, we've had her on
the show. There's a bunch of people. And the next thing you can also teach as an instructor is also sustainability, because, you know, it's not just about taking, but also it's about, you know, learn to live with the environment and also exchange with the environment. So my philosophy is to actually plant more than I will ever take, for example.
Wow. Yeah, that makes absolutely all the sense in the world. And I love the idea of like this not being something you can really just study but from books. You need to learn hands-on from somebody who knows. And I, you know, the idea of sharing that knowledge once you do become an expert, I think is really important. Because not everyone's going to take it on. So you got to kind of plant your seed wide and far, so to speak, with sharing this, you know, something that could easily get lost through the years. This book is obviously a tremendous effort on that behalf. So what is it? I mean, I'm intrigued by, you know, the differences you found in the U.S. between where you grew up and where you're from. What inspired you about California and its terroir?
Well, originally it was from a survival perspective. So 1999, we're talking Y2K.
Okay.
So the end of the world was coming. But I started to think again in terms of like, well, you know, what will happen and, you know, how to find food. And I did a lot of class with survivalists. And I found out that there was a bunch of incredible flavor, but nobody was really doing anything with it.
Oh.
And that's why I became obsessed. I'm going like, gosh, so many flavors, so many good stuff, but, you know, this is
We're
gourmet
sitting
food.
On it, yeah.
And nobody was doing gourmet food with it. So I started to really investigate what could be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I live in Los Angeles, so I would say like 90 to 95% of what we forage is actually non-native.
Mm-hmm.
It came from Europe.
Interesting.
So I'm completely at ease in the environment because it's practically the same stuff that I find in Belgium.
Ah. Yeah, so a lot of similarities then. Well, that's good.
Same thing in New York, by the way. There is so many people that came from all kinds of different countries. Guess what? You got the seeds that came with them.
Yeah, Well, we don't have all that you know goodness that California typically has, but you know, for instance, I'm looking at all your recipes for olives, which I'm very jealous about.
Right.
So olives are all over Southern California, and you know, they just fall off the trees typically.
Yeah, but they're not native. For example, they all came from Italy.
Right.
You know, we have figs everywhere. It's also not native, so we have a tremendous amount of stuff. But yeah, it's all that pieces came from Mediterranean area.
You know what's one thing that is in my area? So I'm from New York, New Jersey, and I've always seen mulberries just fall all over the place. And, you know, those red, or not red, it's like blackish blue, you know, they get stomped on and just smush, and then they start to smell fermented as they decay on the pavement over the place. That's perfectly good berries, isn't it?
Yes, so you can actually do mulberry wine, that you can make mulberry vinegar, you can make mulberry sauce. I mean, the amount of stuff you can do is unbelievable.
Yeah, it is really unbelievable that we're taught not to eat that. That's what I recall growing up.
I know, it's so funny.
Okay, so you know, a lot of this has to do with education. You know, should we just, you know, kind of keep our eyes open and recognize wild plants for what they are? And I love that message that you share tremendously.
You know, to be honest, 80% of what you see in the wild can be used for culinary use. Mm-hmm. Maybe only 5% will kill you, if that.
You're
talking like 80%. Yeah.
Right. I mean, when you say it, and this book makes so obvious, I just feel so dumb. But, you know, if I go and talk to somebody like my coworker or something like that, they're going to think I'm crazy if I suggest eating something. So it's just, we have a little bit of a bridge to cross, but we're getting there, hopefully.
You know, that's what I do in my class. We actually go around, and then I make a little bit of food at the end so people actually can eat. And they suddenly you see this light going in their head, going like, oh, my God, this is good. This is gourmet food. Yeah.
Right. For instance, I love the simplicity of your rosin-baked potatoes recipe. And so you take the – what exactly is rosin? Could you explain what –
Rosin. So rosin is actually clarified pine resin.
Yes.
And in the old days, and it was mostly on the East Coast, actually, in some location, they would actually boil or basically produce turpentine. And the way you produce turpentine is by removing turpentine from resin through boiling and all kinds of different stuff. And they will take whatever was left after the process, which is pretty much resin that has been boiled over, and which is now called rosin. So it's purified of terpene and everything that's bad for you. And they will actually cook with it. And when you cook it actually looks like oil. And when it's a high temperature, and they can put a potato in it and cook it, and it makes the best potato in the whole world, apparently.
It sounds wonderful. I can just sort of, because, you know, it's a little bit similar to the sticky resins in rosemary, which we often have with roast potatoes as well. So I would love to try making rosin. Sorry. It just sounds like such a great craft for fall.
You can actually buy rosin online if you want. Yeah. You know, it was very popular in the 1920s to actually cook with it.
To cook with it? No kidding.
Yeah.
All right. So that's one hopefully we'll remember and reclaim.
Unless you want to forage for weeks and collect a little resin from trees and then boil it, it's very smelly, by the way. It's not something you want to do inside your house.
Oh, really? I thought it would be like, smelled wonderful. Okay.
It's overwhelming. It is absolutely overwhelming. I felt that too, and my wife was not very happy the first time I did it.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Good to know. Well, another fall one, or actually right around this time, because we have so many peppers, and I for one, have a pepper plant that is exploding right now with hot peppers. You have a fermented hot sauce with wild greens that sounds really, really good. How did you come up with this recipe?
Well, I do a lot of fermentation, and because I'm a forager too, so I basically just started playing around with mixing wild greens like watercress, curly dock, all kinds of different stuff like that with my peppers, and basically just do a regular fermentation with it, and I was surprised. It's really delicious.
Awesome.
I'm even using insects right now. I'm planting insects with that.
That you insects in this hot pepper sauce or just in general?
In the hot pepper sauce,
wow.
But that's going to be for the next book, this book.
Oh, okay. So you're writing about edible insects that you can forage?
Is that God, yes.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
That's so exciting because, you know, we're the protein of the future, as everyone is saying now, is, insect protein, which it's very efficient and it's healthful and it's exciting. So is that your next project then, a cookbook about wild insects?
No, it's going to be like another book similar to the first one, but going even deeper because I've got, it's endless the amount of ideas you can have.
Oh, my goodness. So it sounds like you're just exploding with ideas then for using these foods.
Oh, the more you get into it, the more you realize, the amount of stuff you can do. I think my next book is going to be about making primitive beer.
Okay.
Using wild plants, and then after that, I'm going to do probably the new wildcrafted cuisine 2 or something like that. Like a book about it.
There's so much to cover.
Maybe a different state too. Maybe I can go to Brooklyn and do a book from Brooklyn.
I sincerely hope you do. I hope you do some demonstrations so that we can all learn from and. Maybe some dinners too. I'm definitely going to them if you do hold them. That sounds great. This book is such an eye-opening kind of tome. It's very substantial. So it's going to take me a while to get into the hang of everything here. But I'm definitely looking forward to the next. And I guess that's about all the time we have for today, Pascal. But thank you so much for sharing. And I hope everyone checks out the new Wildcrafted Cuisine, exploring the exotic gastronomy of the local terroir, just out from Chelsea Green this summer. And thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Excellent. I see everyone at Heritage Radio Network next week.
Like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.